Welcome back, everybody, to the XCast. The truth is in here. I'm your host, Tony Black, and we are covering today the 11th episode of Season 1 of The X-Files. It's all about Eve. But before we get there, let me introduce my guest, and he's returning from his appearance on the pilot, our very first episode looking at the show. It's delightful to reintroduce Mr. Lee Howard.
Hiya, Tony. Good to be back. It's felt like it's been a while.
Yeah, it has, actually. It was December, I think, when we recorded the pilot. So it's been nearly half a year. How have you been since?
Yeah, very good. I need to make a confession that I'm focusing solely on, you know, like you're obviously putting out a whole range of kind of X-Files coverage. I am purposely just following like the first season, so I'm kind of waiting for your podcast episodes to land, being able to listen to them and kind of like watching the corresponding episode. So that's been great fun. Like it's of course kind of like stretched the first season out for me, because we're only kind of up to approaching halfway, but I've really enjoyed that. Actually, it's been a really kind of like novel way of revisiting the series, and it's been fantastic hearing all of the guests that you've had on, because they've had such a wealth of knowledge. Sadly, I'm not going to bring as much as them to the table, but as I say, always enthusiasm.
that's the most important thing. That's the most important thing with this. But that's great that you've been doing it like that. That's really good. That's something I'm going to be doing myself for our friends at Always Hold On to Smallville, who are doing a very similar thing to us, but for Smallville. So yeah, I'm really glad. I'm really glad you're getting through season one. That's great. Speaking of season one, let's get into the meat of the episode, then. Let's talk about episode 11, Eve.
Hello, and welcome to the Luther Stapes Center for Reproductive Medicine. I'm Dr. Sally Kendrick, a specialist in the exciting field of in vitro fertilization.
She was a resident here in 1985. Brilliant. First in her class at Yale Med, where she got her MD, after completing her doctorate in biogenetics. We were thrilled to get her.
And now you don't sound so thrilled.
We have reason to believe that Dr. Kendrick was tampering with genetic material of fertilized ova in the lab prior to implant, experimenting with eugenics.
Did you report this to the AMA?
Of course. And I fired her. I also requested an investigation from the U.S. Health Department.
And what happened?
The AMA censured her. My request for an investigation was denied. Dr. Kendrick disappeared.
We know the pain of infertility, and we are ready to help.
Eve is the 11th episode, as I say, of the first season of The X-Files. It first aired on December the 10th, 1993, and it was written by Kenneth Biller and Chris Brancato, directed by Fred Gerber. The episode sees Mulder and Scully encountering two girls with identical faces who both had their fathers die at exactly the same time. A very key mystery for these guys. So Eve then, Lee, where would you rate it out of 10, roughly?
Oh, right, yeah, I noticed that you were doing that. I can't remember whether we gave numerical ratings to the pilot. But, to be honest, I actually think this is probably like a high 7, a low 8 for me. I mean, I think we'll get into it more as we get into the discussion, but I think it's a really kind of like solid entry. I know it's another of these Monster of the Week stories, and sometimes they can be sort of identified as like the filler, you know, like in any long multi-episode season you get a lot of filler. I think this is actually quite an interesting departure and a welcome one, really, because they do that interesting thing of like making you think at the beginning it's potentially going to be another investigation into like alien abduction and like the aliens are responsible for the mutilation of the blood-let corpses. But now it becomes much more grounded in, I guess, like a sort of police procedural, you know, the whole kind of idea of potentially of a serial killer. And I won't dive ahead because obviously there's like a major kind of like theme that the episode explores. But no, I would say it's one of the stronger ones that I've seen so far. Of course, you did Ice, which was absolutely fantastic. And I know you've got another brilliant one coming up soon, Beyond the Sea. Mm. But I would say, yeah, so whilst Eve, I don't think, matches those as the particular highlights, it's certainly among the top tier of the episodes that you've covered so far in the first season.
Yeah, I think I would on the whole agree, really. I would give it a 7 as well. And I think it doesn't necessarily live up to its promise or completely, Eve. I think the first half is much stronger than the second half in many respects, but I think it's got a really interesting story, and it's one of the rare, you know, you mentioned how it takes you down a different alley, really, than it appears at the beginning, but it's got a really rare thing where it starts with a genuine mystery and you're not necessarily sure quite where it's going to go. And that doesn't always happen in the X-Files. You know, in the episodes we've covered so far and the ones we will cover, sometimes it's pretty clear what the mystery is, what the paranormality is. In this case, it's a genuine what's going on here, and then ultimately it takes a different turn to what even Mulder expects. So it's an interesting one. It's an interesting story, and it's a bit different in some respects, and as you say, quite police procedural. So yeah, I like it as well, and I would put it in the top 10, I think, probably roughly, of the season. So it's quite a good one. There's some interesting backstory to this episode. This was a freelance pitch by Biller and Brancato, who have got form writing for other shows. Kenneth Biller was a writer for Star Trek. His name you cropped up on various other things. And Chris Brancato, I believe, has written for other stuff as well. They came in and pitched a bunch of stories, according to Glenn Morgan. And they originally called this The Girls from Greenwich, which is a direct take from the film which inspired this installment, which was The Boys from Brazil. Have you seen that one, Lee?
I haven't, but I am aware of it. And of course, that kind of, I'm sure, gives away to the listeners what the theme is, you know, that we're going to be talking about things like eugenics and human cloning. So, yeah, no, it didn't surprise me that that was a reference point, because that is a kind of like a well-known film, which is a large omission of my own personally. But, I know some of the actors involved and what it's about. And I think generally, actually, the whole idea of like the human cloning is a theme of sci-fi, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, The Boys from Brazil is it's not a great film, but it's an interesting film. It's a good film, and it's got some amazing actors. And yeah, I won't tell you much about that, but if you go and look at The Boys from Brazil, you'll see some similarities. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, doesn't it tie into the whole sort of the idea of the Nazis and eugenics and, you know, trying to breed a superior race? So, yeah, I mean, this episode's certainly drawing upon that, but it's also, you know, left a legacy of its own, because watching it again, it really, really reminded me of James Cameron's Dark Angel with Jessica Alba, you know, like the early 2000s TV series, like that whole idea of infant clones, you know, and that, you know, their kind of like superior attributes. And that obviously went in a different direction, having like the young female clone as the kind of heroine of the story. But yeah, no, it's just, again, another reminder that X-Files is all about these kind of interesting themes and tropes, and they actually kind of like carry on, like they bring something to that discourse, and it gets carried on by other people later on.
Absolutely, yeah. And this was the only episode that Biller and Brancato ever wrote. Brancato went on to create First Wave, which was a short-run TV series in the late 90s about an alien invasion. And he actually was quite well promoted. You know, at the time, people were thinking, oh, this could be really good. It didn't really live up to the promise. It had a really interesting idea behind it, First Wave, as to where it potentially would go. So I would encourage anyone to look up that, actually, because it's quite interesting. So, they came in and wrote this, and it was it was basically picked up because the writers didn't have anything else to go with. The production staff didn't have any, the regular writing staff, people like Glenn Morgan, Howard Gordon, etc. There was no other script, so they didn't have one ready. So
that's interesting. So this was then, by all intents and purposes, then a filler episode. Yeah. So I'm impressed even more then, actually, in retrospect, that it came off so satisfyingly as its own kind of like self-contained standalone episode.
Well, it could be because Morgan and Wong ended up doing a rewrite of it.
That's right, because they gave, I remember now, because they inserted their wives' names, didn't they, into the story or something? Yeah.
I think they did, yeah. So it was something that they gave a polish, and it came out pretty well. So let's get into the episode a bit then. Let's start talking about it. It begins with introducing one of the two girls who are quite crucial to the story. In this case, Tina Simmons, who is the he was a little girl in what seems to be a very traditional suburban environment in Greenwich, Connecticut. You know, the camera actually shows you a very traditional middle class kind of American road. Everything would seem to be quite idyllic and nice. And then you've got the image of Tina being like a very much a little girl lost, you know, holding her little teddy bear, you know, looking for help from people. And I think it's a short teaser that starts with a certain, I think, kind of traditional sense of America, and then ends with a real burst of horror when you see her dad, her father, and the way he's been killed. I think it tries to lull you into that a little bit, personally, I think.
Yeah, no, I love always that combination of like the calm before the storm, or the kind of the murder comes home, you know, like how Halloween was so successful, that idea that, you know, suburban America could be the site of, you know, this rampaging serial killer. So, yeah, anything that can kind of disturb the equilibrium, I guess, of, you know, suburban society is right up my street. You know, Lynch did it so perfectly with Twin Peaks and Blue Velvet. So anything like that is great. And like you say, I really enjoyed the setup being that, sorry to jump ahead, you know, that we soon learn that there's another murder that's happened at exactly the same time in similar circumstances, and how that brings the this episode much more in line with a crime procedural or a murder mystery, rather than, you know, like the alien angle.
And, you know, we're already at the point really with the show in that it can be various different things. You know, the previous episode was much more of a, not quite Mission Impossible, but it was much more an espionage thriller, you know, where Mulder, Fallen Angel, where Mulder's basically going undercover into UFO sites and hiding under army trucks and, you know, in black jumpsuits. And then,
yeah, that was a great episode for like the mythology though, and also kind of bringing in a sort of surrogate believer, I guess, for Mulder to kind of like befriend. So yeah, you're right, very, very different, but I would say equally strong, actually, that episode.
Yeah, and we covered that last week with Andrew Brooker, but it's an interesting way, the fact they can, you know, that, like you mentioned Ice before, you know, that which was very much a take on The Thing by John Carpenter, and it can go into different kind of styles of episode already, and it's showing that it can do that. And that was one of the things that the show ultimately becomes very famous for. And this is, like you say, this is much more of a police procedural kind of murder mystery, essentially. So the vision of the father on the swing in the middle of his idyllic garden with his completely exsanguinated is quite chilling. So it's a good image to kickstart the episode off with.
Yeah, I'm pleased that you pronounced the was it sanguination, like the process of blood loss to, I don't know, to obviously you lose enough blood that it causes death. But yeah, I was really impressed with the delivery of that line by one of the young actresses.
She did that quite well. I wonder how many takes that took for it to get that. Once we come out of the credits, though, we've got the traditional briefing from Mulder at the FBI, and he's immediately barking up the wrong tree, isn't he? Because he's seen the murder of Joel Simmons, the father, and he's straight away thinking cattle mutilations, which is a classic paranormal phenomenon, isn't it, that I'm sure you've heard of before.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was cattle in particular in this instance, but yeah, I mean, again, he's like referring back to that kind of idea of unsolved, yeah, mutilation of animals, where, you know, often sometimes you end up finding out that it's been caused by a wolf or a dog or something. I don't know, but yeah. It's very familiar territory, but I guess it works because a lot of this episode is about the misdirection that the girls put out, and that Mulder in particular swallows completely. And it's again another opportunity to show Dana Scully is the more level-headed or the more insightful in some respects investigative force in their partnership. But Mulder always seems to come good in the end. I mean, I think that's why a lot of people have such deep affection for him. He's a character that I think actually, as you go through the first series, is shown in certain episodes to have particular flaws or vulnerability, but he's always, you know, well-meaning, and he's able, more importantly, to show growth as a character because he kind of overcomes those things. You know, I'm thinking in particular, obviously, you get in the next episode his pathological fear of fire and how he has to tackle that.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And he's not one to, you know, stick to his guns when he thinks he's gone down the wrong track. And, you know, there's a point point in this episode where he realises that, you know, the cattle mutilations and the UFO connection isn't right. I mean, Scully makes the point at the very beginning during this briefing. You know, she says, don't cattle mutilations involve UFOs? There's been no sightings or anything like that. And Mulder tries to come back and mentioning how time loss in abduction cases is a big factor. And there's a nice little callback to like The Pilot and, you know, episodes like that, Deep Throat and whatnot, that we've seen before about time loss. But it's the whole thing of immediately Scully's planting the seed of doubt and going, well, this doesn't quite add up as UFOs. And it's also a little bit of a thing where if you think about the episodes we've had so far, there've only been about three or four episodes out of the first 11 that have been not alien based in some way. If you think about it, most of them have been connected to some kind of aliens, whether it's the space ghosts of space or the parasites of ice, or, you know, Fallen Angel, as we mentioned, or, you know, the UFOs in Deep Throat, whatever. Most of the stories have been alien connected. And this one seems to be taking us up that road again, but there's a little seed of doubt straight away. So
yeah, that's actually, I think that whole fine balancing act that they kind of introduce in the first half of the episode works really well, because once Mulder then goes to interview Tina, she seems to kind of like confirm his initial hypothesis that it is like, I think, what did she say? Something like spacemen or the men from the clouds are after my dad. And yeah, and something about like red sky, which I think Mulder might have mentioned previously. So that's a really good way of almost fulfilling audience expectation and making us think, oh, right, so this is where we're going with this one.
Yeah.
And again, you know, that just makes the ultimate sting in the episode's tail much more satisfying. And for Mulder as well, you know, the fact that he has been gotten the better of, as it were.
Definitely. That scene with Tina does have the, like you say, it tees up where we think it's going, but it also, as we've mentioned about the exsanguinate line, it has the first clue that something's not quite right here, because there's a look on Mulder's face as if to say, how do you know that word?
Almost like she's read his mind or something.
Yeah, exactly. But at this point, as an audience, if you didn't know what we know with hindsight, you would think perhaps this is a case of alien abduction and these girls have been, you know, experimented on in some way and they might have some sort of psychic power. You might go down that road, so that the episode does a good job, I think, of completely... When it does take the right turn into the actual guts of the plot, it doesn't do it in a weak way that some of the other episodes do, where it completely sidefoots you. This is a natural sort of veer off. So it's...
It's been well plotted, and well kind of like foregrounded.
Exactly. And then when you get the mirror image murder, which we soon find on the other side of the country in San Francisco with the Reardon family, it's Doug Reardon is the father's name. It's a really good moment where you go, ooh, what's this about? Because this is very strange. But then again, does it confirm the alien thing? Because it happened exactly the same time, Pacific Standard. Does it again suggest that there's an alien reason behind it?
Yeah, well, I mean, Mulder seems to be enjoying himself a hell of a lot, more than you would suspect in a kind of child kidnapping and a double homicide. So I think he, at this stage, is like almost unreservedly hopeful that it is going to be proven to be aliens. Because doesn't he? I mean, even when he finds out the method of death, he's sort of talking about how they were running on empty or something. You know, he's got that inappropriate gallows humour, and it becomes more evident. And he's talking about how the local police didn't look in the right direction for the girls when they were kidnapped, you know, pointing up to the sky. So, yeah, he seems to be having a good time.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, it's true, actually. Yeah, he's kind of hoping it's his normal standard. Although Scully at this point suggests that there might be two serial killers at work, working in different parts of the country, and he bats that away quite quickly. I think that makes sense, given his past in violent crimes, you know, that he would be able to recognise, I think, a double homicide serial killer kind of thing. And I think the fact he says, no, it's not that. But it's not just that he wants to cling on to the alien thing. I think that's his experience coming out as well.
I think you're right. I think it's also potentially David Duchovny as an actor getting more and more comfortable in Mulder's skin. You know, I mean, he's a character that's had already great one-liners, and I think the humour aspect of Mulder's character just becomes more evident, you know, as we go along through the episode. So it could just be, you know, again, at the beginning of this, it's more kind of emphasising the more jocular nature that they're adopting. You know, they're much more comfortable around one another.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
Him and Scully, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. The plot, obviously, at this point, has set up the two murders, and now we get the scene with Tina being kidnapped, and it's quite ominously done, this, and it's intentionally
shot. It's impressive, actually.
Yeah, but it's intentionally shot, I think, to continue the mystery and the uncertainty as to what the episode is about, because you don't see, you know, it's pretty obvious at this point that it's one of the older Eves who've kidnapped Tina, in hindsight, but when it's filmed, it could be an alien, it could be a government person, it could be something else. It's shot very intentionally to make you not sure.
Definitely. I mean, it deliberately obscures your view of the perpetrator through like the editing and the framing, but more than that, because you get like the lightning storm flashes and the tingly strings on the soundtrack, it is, you know, it's just a well-staged set piece, that abduction from the social services safe house. I think also what's clever about it, and why the episode, I guess, works for me, is it allows you again to have sympathy for Tina, because like we're kind of, the way that that's been staged, you are seeing it from her perspective, and certainly your emotional sympathy is with the young girl. You know, that misdirection again, that you think, oh, you just automatically assume that she's the vulnerable victim in this scenario, whereas of course we learn later on that she's anything but a helpless little girl.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it does a very good job of, and the actresses do a very good job actually. The twin girls who play these parts of playing that vulnerability and that, you know, without tipping the hand too quickly, which I think is very good. This now is the moment where obviously you get the twist in the tale, effectively, because Mulder and Scully know that Tina's been kidnapped, but they need to go and see Cindy, the daughter of Doug Reardon, and then they open the door and she looks the same. I think there's a great double take almost between Mulder and Scully, which is well played, of them going, but Tina? I thought that was really good, because they have no idea. They're as shocked as we are. It's like, because this is the other thing with this episode. Normally, quite often in mystery stories that maybe aren't as well executed, you're a little bit ahead of the characters. And in this one, you're not. This one, you're very much with Mulder and Scully. As they're seeing where this is taking them, you're there with them. It's not that we have a little pre-existing knowledge.
Yes, at this stage, I would say that's true. Obviously, that changes in a kind of key scene later on. But no, I agree. And I like the way they kind of, Scully in particular, kind of looks at her with a growing intense scrutiny, almost as if like, who is this person then? Yeah, no, obviously it primes you. You want to find out then, you know, what's the explanation then if we're not going down some kind of outlandish paranormal reason? You know, how could it be then that you've got these you know, twin girls and they don't know each other's whereabouts? And of course, then they've both seen their father's murders. And I think Mulder even sort of says that. What are the odds that that would happen?
Yes, yeah, he does, yeah. Because he's right, you know, it would be... Because Scully's talking about coincidences, you know, and he says, well, come on. What are the chances that this would happen to two girls who were, you know, related with different dads? And it's again, an interesting thing to say. The scene with Cindy's mother and her reaction to getting a photo of Tina is really good, because she at one point thinks that the dad of Tina, who was killed, maybe took her own daughter.
Although that was a good
beat. A good beat, because that's what you would do, I think, wouldn't you? You'd go, oh my God, did something happen to my daughter? Because you wouldn't immediately go, oh, that's a twin girl. Because if you've never only had one child, it's a good moment, because that's immediately, I think, where you would go as a mother.
Yeah, no, that's true. And that's handled certainly better than when we see Cindy's mum again at the end of the episode, which I guess we'll save till then. I've got an issue with kind of how they resolve that. And I would argue that her acting and the kind of direction that her character goes in is far too black and white. Whereas this, I suppose you're right, feels more authentic.
Yeah, it does. It does. I really also enjoyed Mulder's excitement when she mentions IVF, because he literally goes, what, you had in vitro? As if to say, oh, this is a big clue.
and it's interesting to see their investigation go down that whole kind of route of adoption or of... you know, scientifically aided births and things like that. It makes it feel like a bit of a departure for the X-Files at this stage.
Yeah, it does. And it's, like I say, it's a good right turn the episode takes, because it's going into different territory. And I liked the fact then, as they're leaving, Mulder's talking about the abduction of Tina, and Scully says kidnapping, and he says potato, potato.
It's just this, you know, the humour again, and like this, just their easy exchange. Like, it's like they're talking about obviously very serious things, but they've got to a point now, particularly after, you know, events that happened in Ice, where, you know, these are two people that can, you know, they can talk about serious issues in a light-hearted way and not take offence. You know, they're not necessarily, even if they've got disagreements and things like that, they're both like willing to kind of listen to the other person.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I think I like the fact that there's a distinction between kidnapping and abduction in Scully's mind. You know, abduction, I think she already associates with aliens. Because of the amount of things that Mulder talks about alien abduction, he doesn't say alien kidnapping. Then in her mind, there's a difference. To her, Tina's been kidnapped. She doesn't want to continue Mulder's thing of... All the way through the episode, she's saying, so you don't think this is UFOs anymore? You know, so there's a lot of her trying to go, well, it's not aliens, is it, Mulder? You know, just let's keep on the normal track.
That ambiguity is great. And again, that kind of returns when they're kind of getting closer to a sense of who it is that has taken the girls, there is a perpetuation of this idea of what the motive is. And, you know, they have kind of like a disagreement on that. And, you know, like, is it to harm the children or is it to, you know, because they want to abscond with the girl somewhere?
So now they split up. Mulder rationally thinks that, you know, if Cindy's potentially going to be kidnapped, that he ought to stick about and keep an eye. But Scully goes off to the IVF clinic, and we get a bit of exposition here of precisely a little bit more of the backstory of this. And this is where we get our celebrity spot of the of the week, which is Harriet Harris, who plays Dr. Sally Kendrick, or one of the Eves, as it turns out later on, who immediately, I'm sure you're familiar with Frasier.
Yeah, I haven't seen many shows, but I know that she's on that. But I was more aware of her because she was in Christopher Nolan's Memento as Mrs. Jenkins, I think.
She was, actually. Yes, I forgot about that.
And that's only because I've obviously got more familiarity with that film. And I think she's also been in Millennium as well.
Okay. Right, yeah. I think she... because I've got... you're probably right, somewhere. I'm not quite sure off the top of my head where, but I bet she was. She's a great actress.
But she's been in loads of TV. Yeah. She's Desperate Housewives and things like that.
She's done tons of stuff. She's probably, though, still best known for playing BB in Frasier, which was Frasier's really flamboyant, crafty agent. And she only cropped up, like, every so often, but she was fantastic. She used to steal the show and go, "Frasier, darling," and all this. It was brilliant.
She does a great job here, actually, having to portray multiple characters and also multiple personalities.
She's a really good character actress, actually. It's a shame she's not better known, to be honest, and she hasn't done a bit more in movies and things like that, because she is really good. And she immediately, we were introduced to the story of Sally Kendrick, and that she was experimenting with eugenics in the IVF clinic, and that there was a denied investigation for her, you know, her mispractice, and then she vanished. So there's already a little hint, isn't there, of a conspiratorial government element lurking behind this, isn't there, at this point?
And also we get explanation of how the girls can physically resemble one another.
Yes.
So in a way, it kind of, again, makes you think, oh, okay, so there's reason for that, and maybe some of my suspicions, you know, if I've got any initial ones around them, will abate. And again, you know, I just think they do so well at keeping the mystery, or, like, you know, the real actual reality of what's going on from the viewer.
Yeah, absolutely. This is, though, I think the point where it starts to clarify precisely where we're going, but I think it also starts to lose a little bit of a step, because this is the bit where Scully comes back and she tells Mulder about, you know, what she found at the clinic, and then there's a phone call, and there's a few clicks on the line, and Mulder's, you know, there's that funny exchange where Mulder's hurrying her out of his hotel room, and she goes, "Oh, you got a girl coming over?"
Yeah, and he says, "What's a girl?" Yeah, no, I loved all that, because getting this idea that he doesn't have. You know, we're getting more, it's more foregrounded that Mulder's lack of, like, sexual relationships.
Yeah, exactly. Although that comes into question in the next episode, but we'll get to that.
I think that they've almost anticipated that, you know, like, by bringing it up again here, that you know, they share an intimacy, Scully and Mulder, in a professional but also in a friendship way, that, you know, that neither of them are getting any in a way, or Mulder certainly isn't. So she knows full well something's up, because A, he's not going to be sleeping with a girl, and secondly, he's not going to be, like, going to bed early and finishing up thinking about, you know, the work.
Yeah, exactly. She's already a bit suspicious of what's going on, but he's obviously, his reaction to the clicking phone, immediately he knows that there's something up there, and he knows... And that obviously turns out to be the signal from Deep Throat, because what I quite liked, I mean, it's great to see Jerry Harding back in an episode as well, because he's always brilliant. And even though he very, very briefly pops up here, he adds some important stuff. But what I thought was interesting is how Deep Throat contacts Mulder in this case. And it's usually the other way around. It's usually Mulder trying to get in touch with him to get some info. But Mulder, at this point, only just heard, got the fringes of something being covered up with Kendrick's work. But it's Deep Throat now, who's obviously watching the case. He's monitoring what's going on. And he now pops up and goes, "Have you heard of the Litchfield experiments?" And all this.
Yeah, a bit of exposition. Yeah.
And he sort of throws it in. You know, do you think that it's a little bit of a... sort of, they get to a point sometimes, I think, in the first season where when they've got a little bit of a conspiracy angle in some of the plots, they don't quite know how to get to the next stage. So they've
certainly got Deep Throat to come in terms of, yeah, exactly, yeah, and fulfill that kind of role that, you know, provides them not only with some of the background information they need, but then sets them off in a different direction. Because I think he's the one who arranges for them to be able to go and see, you know, like, one of the other Eves. And by this point, he's kind of outlined the idea that it's What is it? It's some kind of like rival super soldier program or something, you know, about genetically modifying children, isn't it? That they can then compete against, you know, I think, was it the Soviets in this case? I can't remember who they said it was that they were competing against. It was a Cold War kind of race to create a superior race or something like that.
Yeah, it was the early 1950s, and it was highly top secret. All the files were burned, and it was based on basically creating a super soldier program with boys called Adam and girls called Eve. And the program obviously didn't really work and have an element of success. But yeah, that was the ultimate goal of it, I think, to create a better soldier, basically, to fight the presumably the Third World War that they thought was coming. So, you know, or, you know, retroactively, you know, whenever I watch these episodes now, I'm always trying to think, how does this connect to the alien conspiracy? You know, so you've got, retroactively, you could say this might be some sort of connection to the super soldier program we see later on in the series, you know, or the alien virus experiments, all that kind of stuff. But obviously, at this point, the writers didn't know that. This was just another shady government conspiracy. But yeah, it does provide the bridge. And even though I do think it's sometimes a bit of a cheat, but luckily they've got such a good actor in Deep Throat and Jerry Hardin that it's always a pleasure to see him come in and just drop a little file in Mulder's lap and say, here you go, that's where you're going, head that way. So they get away with it, really. So, but now they're in the prison where, the insane asylum, as it turns out. And it's very, I think they were going for a Silence of the Lambs vibe with this. But did you find it was a little bit like, a little bit cheesy, because
a lot of it is, though. And I think sometimes that watching, you know, revisiting the older episodes in particular, I don't always find that a negative now, like, whereas I might have been more critical at some point. I think the time that's passed in between has allowed me to have a fondness almost for some of the flaws. So you're right, they are very much going for this kind of like subterranean expansive psychiatric prison, and you know, it's all like doors being shut, isn't it, like the chain doors being pushed across, and you know, them being left in there in the darkness as they approach, who, you know, because it's all dark and they have to go into the cell with just torches. So I guess, yeah, you're right, it doesn't really convey fear, does it? It is all a little bit hokey, but I think it ends up working, because you do get a very kind of like hammy in some regards, but also quite effective performance by Harriet Harris, like you say, where we learn more about the kind of mania or the kind of psychosis you know, like nature always bites back. This scientific meddling did give them advanced strength and advanced intelligence, but it's also meant that they had, what was it, suicidal tendencies as teens and then homicidal character traits after that, or something like that. They've all basically been fucked up.
that's basically it, yeah. It's that they've never become a rational stand, you know, rounded human being, in the sense that they wouldn't be what the ultimate experiments, if they were trying to create a good soldier, they would have wanted a stable, rounded, highly intelligent, perhaps slightly advanced, less impervious human being. What they ended up creating was somebody who couldn't cope, presumably, with all the, as she describes it, I think Eve 6 they talk to, she just describes about extra chromosomes and things like that. She starts talking science at them, which,
that's right, yeah,
which is a good moment, because you wouldn't necessarily expect that from somebody who's, you know, been locked in restraints because she bit a guard's eyeball.
moment of affection or something like that. Yeah,
it's a definite little wink to Hannibal Lecter there. Obviously, as this whole thing is. But yeah, she if she was stable, like, she wouldn't have done that. But it's equally the fact that she still has this intelligence that she can start talking about extra chromosomes. But clearly, the Eves couldn't handle it. You know, they couldn't reconcile that, so they had to be either, well, you know, they either killed themselves or they were killed as they got into adulthood, except for the ones who are still around.
Yeah, and they are obviously they've got different physicality. Oh, well, it's the same actress. They exude a different presence, and I thought that worked well. Obviously, they've all got these inherent genetic flaws, but she convincingly makes you believe that they are different people when those different kind of clones come into the episode.
It's a bit of a precursor to Orphan Black, actually. I don't know if you're familiar with that show.
I've seen the first few episodes. For whatever reason, I then kind of dropped off because I was watching something else, but I will go back to it, because I think from what I hear, it does get better as it goes along.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I've only seen the first season so far, but I did enjoy it. And it, Tatiana Maslany, who plays the clones in that, because it's no revelation to reveal they're clones, everyone knows that. But they, you know, she's really good at inhabiting all kinds of different characters who look exactly the same, but really bringing a different physicality and everything. And it's, she's terrific in, you know, she's the best thing about the show. And in this case, Harriet Harris does that same thing with the three or four different Eve. Three, I think it's three different Eve she plays.
Yeah.
And it's great because with this Eve, you know, she's got gammy teeth. She's all a little bit unhinged, but she equally, you know, understands what's going on. And then she talks about how they've kept her alive because they're still testing her, basically. Because they, and this is the first suggestion that these experiments haven't quite finished, that there still is something else going on, not necessarily just with Eve 7 and Sally Kendrick and all this, but actually maybe the government itself. And, you know, that comes into play a little bit later.
Yeah, you're right, actually. I guess, like, why would they bother to house them and, like, have to feed them? Like, they would just terminate them, you would have thought, if they had this kind of, like, ruthless government conspiracy. You're right, they're obviously keeping them alive for their benefit, not the inmates.
Exactly, yeah. The other thing I thought was that it reminded me also a little bit of the whole Star Trek thing with Khan and the eugenic creations of his. That was the other thing that I thought of, because it's a similar concept in that they were genetically created supermen who ended up being psychotic. And, you know, you had the only difference.
Discarded, yeah.
Yeah, and then in their case, they ended up rising up and trying to, you know, seize control of things, and then they were exiled and things like that. But the only difference with this is that there's human cloning involved. But it's just, there's a few different touch points, I think, that this episode does connect to, which are really good in fiction. But then, this is the point where the plot sort of, it puts everything on the table, you know, right, okay. Because you see the photo as well, don't you? The old photo of the young Eves, and they're exactly the same as the young Cindy and Tina. They look identical.
Yes,
so you
right.
know.
So, and we learn that, yeah, so they're Eve 9 and 10, aren't they? Yeah,
exactly. So you know clearly that the experiments have continued, and now you can say, well, Sally Kendrick has created these two new Eves, and God knows how many more, actually. There could even be more out there. And she's, you know, she's done that. But I thought this was where it goes a little bit much more into thriller as opposed to actual sort of police procedural mystery, because you've now got them looking for the girls. Once Cindy's abducted by Sally Kendrick, and, you know, you get some gunplay with there, and she's shooting at Mulder and chasing the car.
And Scully goes down like a sack of potatoes.
Well, yeah. Did that strike you as a little bit convenient? Because in previous episodes, she's either kicked some ass or she's actually been taking people down in, like, chases.
Well, in her defence, she has to say later on, she's so strong, you know, like, you've got to treat her. Like, she's, like, really dangerous.
Yeah. I don't buy that. I think that was convenient, you know. As I've talked about in the other podcast for the X-Cast, there's moments in the first season where Scully is used very conveniently for plot, whether she's abducted she shows a weakness in some way, and it's a very...
Or she's off solving the case, but we spend time, you know, with other characters. That's really apparent in the next episode.
Yes, definitely, yeah. I don't know about you, I just thought this is where it becomes a little bit more rote, slightly. And I became a little bit less interested as we got further towards the end, as I was at the beginning.
Yeah, I think the plot definitely gets more contrived here, because you get the... this is where there's that whole, I don't know, ambiguity about the motivation. So I think Scully thinks that... I think she might even say that she did suspect the girls, or she had started to suspect the girls, having heard the truth about, you know, the Litchfield experiments and seeing the dire consequences when they obviously went to visit one of the Eves in prison. But Mulder seems to override that and say, no, it's about... he's then buying much more into this idea that it's the two fugitive Eves working together, and they want they want to perpetuate their DNA, don't they? Or, like, he thinks they are trying to clone themselves because they want to... you know, like, remain alive and survive, whereas, you know, that he still hasn't got any suspicion of the girls themselves, and he's really quick to actually change tact and believe a different theory, like, more so than if Scully was going to present it to him, because when he finds the girls later on in a scene I'm sure you'll describe in a moment, where the, you know, they're left alive but the other Eve has been poisoned, he is happy to buy into their theory. They're kind of like... story of what happened, that the idea is that the Eves aren't trying to you know, kidnap them to keep them and, you know, bring them up, but actually to terminate them. He's very quick to like kind of turn around and spin on a dime with that, more so than, you know, you think he might have been if that was kind of Scully trying to persuade him.
I did wonder if there might be a flicker of doubt in Mulder, but I think you're right. Overall, he goes with it, really. And I think this is where they could have had a little bit more ambiguity in terms of how the agents are thinking, because if he really did doubt it, I don't think they would have quite done what happened in the climax. I think there would have been a slight change there. I think what before that, though, the interesting fact is how you get a few scenes with Kendrick, Eve Seven, with Tina and Cindy. And this is the point you realise that these girls are genuinely psychotic and that they've been playing everyone pretty much from the beginning. Yeah. But what I thought was interesting is how Kendrick is basically trying. She's not took them to kill them, and she's not took them to continue experimenting. She wants them to actually have a normal life.
Yes,
and I thought that was,
she's actually got her reasoning, her motivation is actually very sincere. Yeah. You're right. She's disheartened to find out about the murders, and then she realizes that they're almost. More that they've got like the greater intelligence out of all the Eves, the greater sort of ability to kind of, do they communicate kind of psychically? I mean, because the actresses do a brilliant job of motioning that understanding, that wordless understanding that they're aware of what the other person's thinking. She's realized that they've got like an accelerated growth in the positive and the negative, and that they've started their murderous behavior far earlier. So she's really disheartened by that and wants to save them from, you know, that kind of criminal life, doesn't she?
Yeah, I thought that was really good, actually. I thought it allows Harriet Harris to play a different kind of character as opposed to all the Eves being crazy. This one seems to be, she doesn't seem to be psychotic. This is the interesting thing. She seems to be, you know, she's clearly, you know, gone off the rails to an extent, but she's not crazy, and she actually wants to try and, you know, her motives perhaps for creating more Eves might have been more sinister in the beginning, but maybe she's had a change of heart, and that when you, like you said, when they killed their fathers, she started to go, I maybe can save them from this. I can maybe save them from becoming us. And
yes, because she says that she was brought up by one of the scientists on the original experiments, and somehow with a regime of medication, she's trying to achieve like a balance. Yeah, she's very much like a maternal figure, isn't she, actually, in that scene, which obviously makes what happens to her all the more disheartening.
Definitely. And it's quite chilling, you know, when they just, you know, the other thing when that you're talking about their psychic bond, you know, they finish each other's sentences, which is a key, you know, aspect to this. And when they're talking about the poison, you know, going, a few ounces of the foxglove plant, and it's all this kind of really chilling kind of, oh my God.
Because that obviously the whole episode is riffing on that trope of like the spooky twins or like the young children, you know, twin sinister characters. And like you're saying, finishing each other's sentences and kind of like mirroring each other's body movement. I mean, the Kubrick's The Shining obviously comes to mind straight away, but even like Edgar Wright does very humorous kind of like little inclusions of sinister twin characters across his TV and film work.
That's true. Interestingly, they found finding the twins a challenge. And R.W. Goodwin, one of the producers, he considered briefly, he thought we should cast one actor and then do a photo double and split screen. But there was so much with the two of them together that it was impossible.
Budgetary, I can imagine there was a lot of limitations.
He said it would also have been very expensive. Yeah, exactly. So yeah. They realised that they had to go and... They had to find some actors, and in the end, they were very happy with who they got.
They lucked out. What are the you know, just obviously to give them a mention because it's well deserved. What are the young actresses called?
Erica and Sabrina Crevins.
Because they've not been in anything else, have they? They're not familiar to me, the names.
No, they were 9 years old when they did this, and they went on to have a minor uncredited role in another film, a very unknown film. I think that was it. Presumably they then went on to, you know, not be actresses, and because they'd be they'd be about 32 now. So
well, they were perfectly confident in this episode, I think. They carried their parts of the narrative really well.
They were very good. They did the job very well. A difficult job, really. So you've now got the point where Mulder and Scully are with Tina and Cindy, who are basically trying to play innocent, and that they were, like you said, they were victims.
Yeah, they were going to be forced to commit suicide. That was it, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that they were victims of Eve 7. And now really the rest of it is basically the climax, which is I think they intended this to be more scary and more chilling than it ended up coming out as being, possibly because of some rather bland direction. I mean, I've thought that Fred Gerber's direction throughout the episode has been quite dry, and really, I mean, there's the odd moment where, like, the moment where Tina's kidnapped is probably the best visually directed piece, but
yes,
I think the rest of it, on the whole, has been relatively dry, and I think it's been the ideas and the script in places that has made it stronger.
Yeah, I think I completely agree, yeah, because it never does, you're right, it never really veers into, like, horror territory.
No.
That kind of isn't the strong suit, and I guess, yeah, I'm actually looking at some of the other aspects of the episode that I kind of, like, hang my enjoyment on, like the performances and, like you're saying, some of the writing initially, and also that the way that Mulder is presented in the episode, from being very jocular and jovial and then to having this kind of seemingly genuine want to have an affinity with these girls, like with these children. I thought that was kind of just an interesting kind of wrinkle to his sort of psychology and personality, that he clearly was someone who suffered a trauma as a child, and in some respects his, like, development into an adult has been arrested in some way, and he wants to befriend the girls, doesn't he, and make sure they're all right and have some kind of kinship, whereas again that kind of makes it all the more impactful in a way, in an understated way, but you do feel sorry because once again Mulder's, like, faith or trust is going to prove misguided. But I guess he's not just a fool, at least once he does work out what's really going on, he does, you know, he gets right down to business to tackle the problem.
Exactly. But the climax point where obviously the girls are basically planning to poison Mulder and Scully and presumably get away, where, you know, you get they go to this convenience, you know, rest stop and stuff.
There's some great vintage 80s arcade machines, I noticed.
That's true.
I think it was Miss Pac-Man might have been one.
You should have had a scene where Mulder just stops and plays them for a bit.
Yes, with the girls, you're right, that would be brilliant.
But I think it's all just a little bit blandly directed in what could have been a really... Although I did like the fact, because obviously at this point, you know, the girls, they get sodas, Tina slips out and poisons them, I think it's Tina, slips out and poisons them, and, you know, Mulder and Scully are seemingly unaware for a while, I just think it could have been a little bit better escalated, although I did like the fact that you don't get lots of moments of Mulder and Scully almost taking a sip and things stopping them, because you know they actually do sip some of this poison, and I thought that was good, because I was like, well, you could have had a lot of instances where somebody goes Mulder, or they have to stop for a car, and oh no, and the girls are like drink in their heads.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that though, isn't there, like where Mulder obviously then very theatrically comes out because he's dropped his keys on the table, which is telegraphed an earlier scene, but then he runs out and goes, I just wanted to open the door for it, like, to Scully, and then she later on has to has this really terrible clunky bit of dialogue where she has to literally point out to us, she says, oh, we didn't drink enough to make us sick, that's why we're all right, everyone, all right.
Yeah, she knows that as well. I mean, exactly that. I thought that, oh, that was, there were some real contrivances, like you say, the keys was a real contrivance, because if they hadn't have been kept there, there's no way they would have found out about the poison. It just felt like a lot of little things they had to put in there in order to get Mulder and Scully not dying.
and of course it ties back and we realise that they have poisoned their fathers, haven't they?
The other thing that really struck out for me in this, obviously, before, you know, they try and run away and they get caught, they get captured in the end, was, you know, there's a moment where there's a school bus leaving, isn't it? I mean, this was pitch black at, like, in a truck stop.
Yeah, like a school trip, was it? But you're right, it was the yellow school bus, wasn't it?
As far as I'm aware, that's the school bus that picks them up at, like, 3 o'clock when they finish. It just seemed really weird. It just felt like
I thought for a minute that we were going to get, like, a Nightmare on Elm Street 2 scenario where the girls were, like, driving the school bus with all the kids screaming at the back.
I think that would have been less ludicrous than the idea that they threw in a school bus because they had to have some kind of child thing, you know, for them to, oh, there was a school bus that left, that maybe that's where they're going. It's like, oh, come on. This whole climax I just thought was really silly, and it just really brought the episode down a bit for me. I think it could have been a lot more tense and exciting and
yes,
gripping.
You're
at the
right.
End.
It does diffuse the mood and atmosphere.
It's a shame, really, because the setup is really good, and it kind of just fizzles out really in a bit.
And then there's, like, the Scooby Doo moment where the girls think that they've got away with it, and they kind of, like, peek out from, I think it sounded like from tarpaulin on the back of a boat or something, it's on a truck, and then Mulder just goes, oh, I've gotcha. Yeah, I got those pesky kids.
It is a bit like that. So, yeah, and this is, now we get the wrap up really, and this is the moment you mentioned earlier, which is Cindy Reardon's mum's reaction to the daughter. This didn't work for me either, because she basically just effectively abandons her, doesn't she?
She disowns her daughter in the instant that she finds out of her admittedly heinous acts of like murdering her husband. But you know, that is not what life is like. I wouldn't have thought, you know, you don't raise a child to the age that she did and then be able to completely, I mean, she even tears a photo and shoves it in the fire to really kind of like underline it. Of course, she's going to have like massive extremes of emotion, highs and lows, and we don't have the time in the episode to bear witness to that. But I think it really just sort of was a quick shorthand to try and wrap it all up neatly. And to, I think it drives home actually for me that in particular this episode, but X-Files in some respects by and large, it's much more a show about ideas and having an interesting kind of like themes rather than like a genuine human drama show. I mean, at least in this episode, because I don't want to do it a complete disservice because there are some great dramatic moments throughout, you know, like the 10 seasons. But to me, that just smacked of dishonesty. I just really didn't think it worked at all.
No, I agree.
But then again, maybe we're spoilt now because we've obviously had, in other genre shows, there's still been an almost recurring prevalence given to like, the human anguish. Like I'm thinking of particularly like the Nordic noir shows like The Killing, like that was literally a 20 episode crime drama where a lot, you know, a huge percentage of that that TV show was spent in the presence of the grieving parents, you know, that you just didn't sort of see that, but you know that they didn't have, they weren't often given the same amount of importance, those kind of emotions in kind of genre storytelling.
No, and certainly not for, you know, supporting characters like
exactly,
like Mrs. Reardon. And it is important though, because it doesn't feel real. It doesn't, you know, this episode is to the beginning, to some extent prided itself on being fairly, you know, fairly procedural,
fairly grounded.
And then there's points at the end, especially, and this is just one of those that makes you go, this wouldn't happen. So it's a bit of a contrivance again in order to completely isolate the two Eves who, you know, have found their way into the creepiest insane asylum. Presumably Mulder and Scully would have handed them over to law enforcement, who then were approached by the government, who had scooped these girls up, put them in this place.
And the mums don't care. Neither mum puts up any defence. Yeah.
Well, the other mum is for Tina is dead, or because you never see her in the episode. So I don't.
Oh yes, yes.
I think she's dead anyway. Yeah. So all their parents are either disowned them or are dead. So there's no family connection there to make kick up a stink. But I thought what I really liked about this was the final little twist in the tale, which is that Eve 8, who we hadn't seen yet, we knew was still out there, but we hadn't seen yet, he's presumably on the payroll for the government, because she manages to get in there as a scientist. She has ID, she's cleared, and she walks in and she says, they say, we've been waiting for you. And she says, how do you know I'd come? And they went, we just knew. We just knew. But it suggests that Eve 8 is actually working for whoever is still perpetrating these experiments. I thought that was really interesting, actually.
Yeah, that is interesting that you've raised that, because I think I must have missed that, because I think I just thought, oh, it means that the girl was kind of somehow knew that where events might transpire, and that actually they might escape, because, you know, now that Eve 8's here, she, you know, dressed as a doctor, she's going to be able to break them out of jail. I didn't really twig that you're saying that actually, no, she's like legit, she does actually work there.
Well, I'm assuming, I mean, you might be right that she stole an ID and that she's got in, but then my thinking is that would be very, very difficult to do, especially given the fact that, you know, you've got,
she's got the same face,
exactly, she's got the same face as these people who've been locked away. So you'd assume, my assumption, it's never clarified and it's very much open to interpretation, but my assumption is that she in some way maybe was raised within the system, and that she is part of the experiments, and that she maybe has been spearheading trying to round all these girls up in order to continue this, and then it's left very open.
Yeah, that would work much better if they were going to do like a return to this theme, like have that idea where the kind of figurehead of the government conspiracy, the kind of oppressor, actually is the same as the people that are suppressed. That would have been an interesting dynamic to see explored, but alas, you know, that wasn't the case. I don't think there ever plans that she would return?
Not to my knowledge, no. I think it was an episode they thought of fondly, ultimately. I know Chris Carter was quite happy. It was a difficult editing process, apparently, but they loved Harriet Harris, quite honest, quite understandably, and they liked the rewrite job. But I don't think there was any plans for another one. Although, you know, it's something I think that I'm surprised the comics that have been recently, you know, season 10 and season 11 comics, you know, separate from the season 10 actual continuity. But it surprises me they haven't picked up on it because it's, and as far as I know, they haven't. And it's an interesting, because it's an interesting, it's left open enough, I think, to explore again. And they could certainly, you know, I don't think they would do sequel episodes in the assumed season 11 that we're going to get eventually. But it would be interesting to come back to this later down the road, because we're 20 odd years later now. You could do a new episode with, you know, maybe Adams instead of Eves, who were like, yeah, teenage boys or like young adults, and it would be really interesting. So it leaves the door open a fair bit, Eve, and it's overall a pretty good episode. So
very satisfying overall. I do agree with what you were saying actually about how it loses a bit of momentum. It could have been more suspenseful and more kind of like sort of ominous in its atmosphere. But yeah, as a potential filler episode, then I'll still come away getting me entertainment's worth, and I think any TV show that, you know, has got so many episodes in a individual season, they need a good couple of standalone ones, and this was, you know, more than adequate.
Definitely, I completely agree there. So that was Eve, the 11th episode of season one. So my next segment is asking Lee, do you believe him? Which is our specific look at the paranormality of the episode. My question to you is, do you believe in human cloning?
What I think in the sense of, yeah, I mean, human, my understanding, and of course I'm a complete Luddite when it comes to this, but my understanding is we've already got to the point where you can clone an animal, because didn't we have Dolly the sheep? Although I'm not sure, is she still alive and well, or was there like a shorter lifespan? I have no idea, but anyway, we've successfully cloned animals, and I can vaguely remember that we even grew limbs on animals. I mean, I think there was that picture of a mouse with an ear on its back or something. And then we, isn't there already research being undertaken now where you can grow part of the human body? Like, they're not cloning an entire human being because of ethical law, not because of the lack of scientific know-how. Is that right? I thought that's kind of where we are at the minute. We're on this tipping point where it could be done, but the scientific community are under agreement that they won't pursue that, but they would still use it. They would still use cloning technology for, what do we call it, you know, like to help us to still function and live longer and like grow limbs and organs and things like that. Because I thought that that was happening.
I think
am I living my life in a sci-fi world?
No, I think it is. I don't know specifics, but yeah, I've heard similar things that they would use it maybe to grow new corneas and things like that to help people who are, you know, losing their sight and that kind of thing. And I think it's that is ethically, I think, fine, really.
I mean, it is incredible. I think it is amazing. Like, that is just, the idea that that can be done, I just think is so kind of like, it must be like cutting edge science, or for the layman, you know, on the street. I still think that is incredible that they could like grow, like you're saying, a particular organ that could then be like, you know, donated to someone that needed it. But I think that surely though, the temptation then, if you can do that, that you can do other things. And I don't necessarily think it will be in this kind of context of, in the future, we're going to have super soldiers. Like, I think that is very much like a Cold War era avenue. But if there's money to be made and there's scientists that can further their career by doing this kind of groundbreaking work, then sadly, I think it will happen. I don't think it can be contained long term to just, you know, yes, someone needs a particular organ so we can do that. There'll be someone there in the community that's got the intelligence and lacks the scruples because they feel they can make money from it. So I don't know what the future is then, whether it's going to be people that are very wealthy that lose someone near to them and don't want to lose that person, is able to clone that person from their DNA, like, or whether it's going to be about people wanting particular types of children, like almost like designer children. I mean, obviously, of course, there's massive ethical issues regarding that, and you know, that's not a reality I'd like to see come to pass. But in a way, I suppose, if I'm speculating, it's something that isn't, I think it's more realistic than saying that we're going to have AI, if that makes sense.
I think you're absolutely right. I think in terms of the fact that it all depends, I suppose, where this kind of technology and this kind of lore goes. You know, if we end up in, there's been a lot of sci-fi films that have covered things like Gattaca, you know, they've covered...
That's a great film, yeah.
Yeah, that have covered, you know, the kind of area that you're talking about in terms of people, you know, being able to buy, you know, cloned people and things like that and actually be able to... And it all depends, I suppose, where the lore goes with it. And I think the crucial thing is... whether we should, and you know, it gets into a lot of other areas, really, as opposed to, you know, you can go into a quasi-religious area as to whether or not, you know, a clone body would have a soul, you know, and all this kind of thing. There's a lot of conceptual philosophical questions about cloning a human being, as opposed to not just the science of it, but in terms of what makes a human being a human being. Is it just that we are a composite of DNA and of, you know, we've been created in effectively a lab, because that's what a womb is in a way. Yeah.
No, you're right. And the repercussions for our own sense of individuality. Well,
yeah, exactly.
You know, and I think it is a fascinating theme, which I would like to see more explored in sci-fi. But it just doesn't seem to be necessarily on the agenda. Although I'm sure there's films and TV scripts being written now that are going to incorporate these things. But yeah, I think the last that I can vaguely remember is I'm sure there was some kind of joint international law regarding like the scientific community and how they were going to stop at the kind of point that they are currently at in terms of using cloning for medical care. But as we've said, I think you'd be very naive to think that wouldn't necessarily change. It only needs to take the economy or a government change to then suddenly, you know, see that the people involved have a different point of view. Scary, but also just, you know, amazing in the sense of what people are able to do now.
Yeah, and what might be. No, it's absolutely true. You never know. Maybe one day there'll be
Tony number two.
Oh God, that's a dreadful thought to unleash upon the world. If you
could send that one to work, and then you could have like the rest of the time off.
That's a great idea. Yeah, that'll do. Actually, I'm happy with it for that. I think if anyone does want to, we mentioned about TV and sci-fi. I think, like I mentioned, Orphan Black is a good example of a show that's about clones. That is interesting. You know, it's principally like a drama, thriller kind of drama, but it's an interesting look at human cloning and things like that. So, you know, give that a check out. But
obviously, Battlestar Galactica. People haven't got to like the rebooted version. That's kind of an interesting example because it's got the whole AI but also cloning theme interwoven into it. And a different kind of perspective in the sense that it isn't just necessarily human beings that have achieved the ability to clone other individuals. So yeah, I mean, and that is just a brilliant TV show.
Yes.
So if you like sci-fi, definitely get to that.
So absolutely true, yeah. Right, so let's tackle the last part of the episode, which is the X quiz, and this is your first go at this because I don't know if we did this for the pilot.
I don't think I got the full quota of questions. I think you were kind on me and you only asked me a few, but this is the part I'm dreading. Go ahead.
Well, we'll see. The top score as of right now is 5 out of 6, which was set by Matt Latham for Space. He hates the fact that he set such a high score for a terrible episode.
Is that the one with the face on the moon or something?
Yes, the space ghosts, which was ridiculous. So you've got that to beat, so we will see how we go. So are you ready for 5 questions and a quote on Eve?
Okay, yep, go ahead.
Okay, let's do it. Question one. How much blood did Joel Simmons lose when he was killed?
Oh, dear. Can I say something like a percentage of his total body blood count or something, or is it like a certain amount of pints or something?
I would give you, well, it's a certain amount of litres, so I'll give you if you get it.
Oh God, this is showing my complete lack of scientific knowledge. I wouldn't even know how many litres of blood do we actually have in our bodies, but I'm suspecting he would have had to have lost, you know, are you going to give me a clue?
Well, it was Scully mentions it. All of these things are mentioned in dialogue. So
I can't remember. I'm going to say something like, you know, 3.
Oh, you were close. 4 liters, is exsanguination. I think that's enough to exsanguinate a body. Yeah. So 4
well,
liters.
Well, that varies, doesn't it, on an individual by individual basis?
I guess so. But close. Not a bad guess. Okay. Question 2. What poison was found in both men? What's the name of the poison that
you mentioned? You said it as well, isn't it? It's like fox lily or something like that.
Foxglove, but the actual poison is something else. It's from the foxglove plant, but the poison is...
Right. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, I'll say it. Digitalis.
Yeah, never would have got it.
Okay, what's the name of the IVF clinic that Scully visits?
Oh, this is so embarrassing. I only literally watched this episode last night.
The questions are hard, in fairness.
It's my age-riddled memory. I'll know this one when you say it, but I'm just not going to get it off the top of my head. No.
It was the Luther Stape Centre.
Okay.
Yes. So. Okay.
I'm going for zero.
No, yeah, right. You never know. You might get some. What family members does Cindy remember when she's praying?
What family members does she remember when she's praying? God, I don't even remember her praying. What, is this at the social services safe house this happens?
This is where she's. She does a little bit of a... She's a scene where she's praying and her mum says, oh, you're very special. And she's doing a little prayer before she goes to bed. And she says, give my love to such and such, such and such. And she remembers a few people from her family. Can you name any of them?
In terms of what, whether it's father or do you mean their actual names?
Well, you know, I'll give you a point for who, what family members they are. But if you give me names, it's even better because she does mention right. them. But I'll give you a point for where they are in the family tree.
Right, I'll just say father and nan and granddad.
Yes, you got a point. So, well, it's both the nans and granddads. It's grandma right. and grandpa Stenner and Irma and Irma Pop. So, yeah, that's a point, though. Yay!
Well, I'd like to think that anyone listening that hasn't actually been invited on yet and, you know, is paralysed with fear at the idea of showing themselves up on the quiz, you know, I'm sending a signal out to them that don't worry, you won't be as bad as me, so do come on.
Oh, dear. Okay, question five. How many Eves do we see in the episode?
Oh, God.
Now this counts.
I think isn't there like three adult Eves and then there's obviously the two girls. Now that would be five, but are you also talking about the fact there was a photograph of like loads of them on as well?
No, you've got it. I'm not going to be that cruel. Okay. Yeah, five Eves basically. From the photo, I don't know how many there'd be actually. I didn't count, but there'd be a lot more. But yeah, five. Well done. That's two. And finally, the quote. Okay, let's see if you can get the character and ideally where and to who. I meant it as a sign of affection.
So this is... I can't remember the Eve number. Is it... I'm going to guess it's like Eve 7. But this is obviously the Eve that's in the psychiatric prison and it's where Mulder and Scully go to talk to her and she's talking about how... You know, she's been in a straitjacket since she last kind of like bit one of the orderly's eyeballs.
That's it. Eve 6, though, but I'll give you the point. I'm not going to be that cruel. Yeah, that's all right. You got three out of six. That's not bad.
Yeah, I vaguely remember. I think I might have been asked four questions or potentially five last time. I think I got three. So I'm consistently terrible.
There you go. It's not too bad, actually. There haven't been... Most people get the average of three, which is pretty good. That's not bad.
Oh, my question's, that's all right, then.
My questions are fiendish. So, well done. Okay, that's Eve. So that brings us to the end, then, of this episode. It just leaves me to thank everybody for listening and for you, Lee, for coming on once again.
Yeah, well, thanks for making space for me. And as I say, I love the fact that you're getting so many different people on to talk through the episodes with you. And I really look forward to the future ones because it's just you feel like you're a bit of a part of a community that we're all kind of like dipping in and rewatching. You know, the first season and then like hearing like quite a lot of different perspectives and as of course your own, you know, being incredibly informative, so I'm learning like so much more about the show and I think that's really enriching my enjoyment of it because like I've said, as much as I've had a long-term affection for the show, I really, there's so much I didn't know and there's so many of the episodes that I've got such a poor kind of like recollection of. So it's been a real pleasure to go back and you know, watch the episodes and listen to the podcast.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, thank you. That's really good that he's doing that. That's brilliant. Until you're back on next week for Fire, where can we find you around?
You could find me on the Movie Matters podcast. So that's Movie Matters podcast on iTunes. All reviews welcome. MovieMattersPodcast.com is the website where you can get all our kind of social media contact details. And if you're a fan of video games, or you once was and you'd like to, you know, try and pick up the controller once again to play more, you might want to listen to Lapse Gamer Radio, which is another podcast you can find on iTunes. And that is, you know, all about kind of getting people who are actively playing games now together with those of us that are more lapsed and kind of sharing the enjoyment of the hobby, because there's great stories to be told in games. There's great fun experiences to share, you know, with friends and family. So it's a medium that offers a lot. And, you know, you'd be doing yourself out of a lot of fun, I guess, if you didn't at least kind of like try and give it a dabble again, despite the pressures of adulthood and the lack of time. So, yeah, that's Lapse Gamer Radio.
Awesome. Both great podcasts. I'm a big fan of them. So, yeah, check them out, guys. That'd be great. You can find us at the X underscore cast on Twitter, on Facebook at the X cast, and we're on iTunes. So if you could subscribe, that'd be lovely. If you haven't already, that'd be great. We're also part of the Black Hole Media Podcast Network at Black Hole Media on Twitter and on Facebook. We've got a group you can join, which has discussion. And yeah, you can find us there with lots of other different podcasts about film and TV, which should be enjoyable listening if you're interested in that stuff. So yeah, we'll see you next week, Lee, for Fire.
Absolutely.
And yeah,
I'll try and take better notes in terms of like the randomness of the questions you might ask, but I can't promise it.
Oh well, we'll see fiendish questions. But yeah, until next week, guys, just remember, trust no one.